I'm Brian, and we're back with another episode of Stream Close Up. Coming to you from I Like Radio's studio number 3, our guest today is the great Gary Lewis. Gary is joining us to talk about his latest project, Rig 45, which is premiering right now on Viaplay. But as always, we'll try to learn a little bit more about the man while we have him up here in the studio. By way of background, Gary is a Scotsman who came late to the acting game. But as you'll find out, when he arrived, he was not messing around. Gary was working in TV and smaller films when he got his big break back in 1999. That's when he was cast as the father, or dad, in the award-winning and much-beloved Billy Elliot. Yeah, he quickly followed up on that success with a key part in Martin Scorsese's Gangs of New York, starring as McGloin opposite Daniel Day-Lewis. Outlander fans will recognize him from his recurring role as the bow-legged Colm McKenzie. And among other films, he's appeared in one of my personal favorites, the Irvin Welsh-penned Filth, as well as Nicholas Winding Refn's Valhalla Rising. His TV credits are just too long to list, but if you take a moment to check out Gary's IMDb page, I'm sure you'll come away impressed. We'll get into his collaboration with directors Peter Mullen and Robert Carlyle. We'll learn how a teacher was instrumental in introducing Gary to classic film and theater at a young age, planting the seed that would lead to his amazing career. We'll get into the importance and influence of the early films of director Ken Loach and how Gary ended up working with him later on. We'll talk to Gary about all this and try to learn how a Scottish garbage man from a working-class estate emerged in later life as an in-demand Hollywood actor. Before we get into all that, I'd like to remind you to follow us on Twitter, at Stream Close Up. From time to time, we'll be posting clips there to illustrate some of the things that we discuss on the show. And you can always reach us via Gmail. We're streamcloseup@gmail.com. So that's streamcloseup@gmail.com and streamcloseup on Twitter. That's how you can reach out and follow along with what's going on here between episodes. All right, enough of that. Let's do it. In for his Stream Close Up, Gary Lewis. Hit it, Jose. And we are in business. Welcome to the studio, Gary Lewis. Hey.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you. Lovely to be here.
So thankful to have you taking the time to join us. Gary might be perhaps the most successful actor we've had here. I was comparing your IMDb page to Peter Stormare, who is a recent guest. And yeah, it lines up pretty nicely. I'm quite impressed.
Well, I don't know how you measure success. There's lots of measurements, but yeah.
I would say I'd measure your success very differently than other performers. First of all, I should say that Gary is up here to talk about Rig 45, his latest project, which will be premiering on Viaplay in June. It's a criminal drama set on an oil rig. Interesting. Very interesting stuff. And I've been lucky enough to see the first two episodes. And we'll get to Rig 45 and his role, Douglas. But before we get there, as we like to do, we want to hear a little bit about Gary's story. And for me, one of the most interesting things about your background is that you came late to acting. You know, you didn't decide at 15 that I'm going to act and make it your choice. How did this all unfold, and where were you in your life?
Yeah, well, at 15, I didn't know where the door was to get in. So in the absence of any knowledge about where the door was, it wasn't really a big idea for me.
Oh, but it was still a thought, though, even then.
Yeah, it was a thought because the seed had been planted by an English teacher at my secondary school, a guy called Murray Learmonth, and he established a film club in the school, a film society. And the school was in the East End of Glasgow, in a huge, basically a huge working class housing estate. And this film society in the school was it was quite a revolution for me. And Murray Learmonth showed us a lot of the early British social realist films, Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner.
And he showed
us Kes, Kes was, Kes exploded for me, one of the early Ken Loach films. So when I saw this representation of a young guy in Yorkshire, it was, it was the first time I'd seen such an in-depth study of a, not study, just to see this picture of a young guy's life, a young working class kid. And it was a great honour for me later in life to be working with the man who made that film, the legendary English director Ken Loach. But so I suppose that planted a seed of thought that maybe I could do that. You know, I could do that. But like you say, it was a long time before I
did it. Awaken any political thoughts to see these kind of films?
Yeah, it did, because seeing Kes and films from that era. Made me realise that there was a huge absence in most representations, most films, as in most books of the time. There were no serious characters, working class characters. They featured in the background or didn't feature at all. So these films were quite revolutionary in that they went to places that other films didn't touch.
Okay, so you have a little influence when you're studying. But you don't jump in right away and say, okay, that's when I leave school, I'm going to chase acting. You do something else.
Oh, geez, yeah. I mean, when I left school, I had absolutely no idea.
Okay, yes. Where do you go? Where is acting?
Oh, man. I mean, what I did do was I went to the theatre regularly. So I maintained contact with it. I wasn't doing it. But I was connected with the theatre. But the same guy took us to the Citizens Theatre and Glasgow and to Dundee to see the Arthur Miller play Death of a Salesman,
okay.
Which was, again, that made a huge impact on me. So I was doing other kind of work, but I was going to the theatre, like, and I would go to the Glasgow Film Theatre where to see films like The Seven Samurai or Jean-Luc Godard. That's how I lost the love of my life, my first girlfriend, because she wanted to go and see The Exorcist and Jaws.
Widow to the classics.
Yeah. That was a Jean-Luc Godard too far. So, so there were these avenues to explore art in Glasgow. And
so you're getting the influences. You're doing the study. You know whether it's focused or not. I mean that is your 10,000 hours of film study. If you're doing
that's it, Brian.
When does it translate to an action that leads to you actually getting a role or getting into a production? I don't even know. Did you start doing something behind the camera or?
Hell no, no. I'd never seen a camera until I started doing short films, which was in conjunction with when I quit the day job. I was mostly doing theatre for years, but there was a kind of a small explosion of short filmmaking in Scotland at the time.
Okay, hang on, slow down. So you're doing theatre roles.
Yeah.
How do you go into your first theatre roles? Are you knocking on the door? Or do you get connected?
No, I mean, the very first was a community drama. Mm-hmm. Basically, what people would normally call amateur dramatics. Mm-hmm. I suppose it was. Nobody was trained. But it was a play. It was a play written by a local man called Freddie Anderson about the life of a Glasgow school teacher, a socialist who was very much to the fore in the anti-war movement, the First World War.
A historical character or a fiction?
A historical character, John McLean. And the name of the play, Krasivy, is a Russian word, and it took its name from a poem by Hugh McDermott about John McLean. And I was working in the... When I left school, I was a street sweeper. I didn't really want to be a street sweeper, but I had to make some money. And then with winter approaching, I got a job in the library. And that's where I met a guy who introduced me to this local drama group. And I played the historical figure.
That's the Rain Dog Theatre?
No, this was called Easter House Festival Society. Okay. Rain Dog came later. Basically, this play won a Fringe first at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, but that didn't lead me to go into acting. I then went and studied history, and it was years later when I encountered Caroline Patterson and Robert Carlyle from Rain Dog. And I started doing plays with Rain Dog Theatre Company And then I had to quit the day job and take it seriously.
So that was like, okay, now I'm making the real move. I'm going to become an actor. I'm all in.
Yeah, that was it. I mean, the dilemma was when you were working with Rain Dog was so exciting. There was lots of improvisation. Basically, but once we took a Mike Lee script and, I mean, Robert Carlyle, I'm actually surprised he didn't direct more films. He was a wonderful theatre director. And the idea was, okay, we're going to add 6 new characters to this
play. Oh, wow.
So find a way to get yourself in there. I used to walk home from rehearsals with my head completely buzzing, but it was exciting.
Yeah, how much fun that must be.
It was great fun. It was terrifying on stage. Sometimes you were just improvising all the time at night, but it was you learned a lot, you know.
And for people who might not know Robert Carlyle, he's Trainspotting, The Full Monty, yeah. Angela's Ashes, among yeah. others. So it
great
must be,
actor.
It must be a nice fertile learning ground for you.
Well, absolutely, Brian. Yeah, it was a very fertile learning ground. And then I started doing short films with likes of Peter Mullen and lots of young directors in Scotland and beyond. And that was my universities, you know.
Your 10,000 hours, as
yeah,
we say.
That was it. I got the flying hours doing these short films.
And not to be impolite, because you look like a fine young man, but how old were you at this point?
Wow. I was, I quit the day job when I was about 33.
33, okay. So coming later than most.
Oh, hell yeah.
People come flying out of the womb knowing that they want to perform sometime.
Oh, some people were quitting by the time I was starting.
Oof.
Yeah, oof. Seriously. I mean, I did a production with 784. We did a tour. It was we took Steppenwolf's version of The Grapes of Wrath, the John Steinbeck book, and there was 16 of a cast. And from that 16, wow, there's maybe only, I don't know, 2 or 3 still acting. Yeah,
tough level of competition in that field, that's for sure. On the other hand, there are more and more opportunities for actors than ever, I think. I mean, given all the streaming services that are producing content as well as the traditional TV, as well as the theater, I mean, it must be a great time to be a performer.
Yeah, there are, there are more opportunities. It kind of depends what you want to do, though. You know, you don't want to do everything which presents itself to you.
It's a lovely place to be able to choose.
Well, it's not, let me see, it's, you're not, I mean, for example, it would be a false assumption to think that we're all just sitting there with hundreds of scripts and picking and choosing. I'm not, you know, I just hope and pray that interesting work keeps coming along.
Well, interesting work has certainly crossed your path. One of the early things is that independent that you did with Kenlock Directing, working with Peter Mullen, My Name is Joe.
Yeah.
Where Peter played the lead, and that thing won awards right and left as an indie production.
Yeah.
Did that echo enough for people to start calling you to find you for work?
That obviously helped. I did a film the same year called Orphans, which was directed by Peter Mullen, which was kind of it wasn't quite social realism. But both those films helped. My Name is Joe and Orphans helped me get seen and maybe opened a few doors. Yeah.
Do you feel that was an important step looking back, sort of as you in building your career?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, most definitely. In fact, much later, after we finished working on Billy Elliot, Stephen Daldry told me that he'd watched me in Orphans that's what.
Waiting until after. They don't say, hey, we saw you in Orphans, we want you in Billy Elliot. They wait till it's done and say, okay, it's because we saw you in Orphans.
Oh, yeah. They make you jump through hoops beforehand.
I mean, we might as well get into it since you bring it up. Billy Elliot, you play the father on Billy Elliot. What's the character's name again?
Jackie,
who's going through a lot, and then his son is also taking him into a whole new world.
Yeah.
That must have been an amazing phenomenon for you. I mean, you do a film, you put in the work, you never know what's going to happen when it's released. Mm-hmm. And that thing echoed around the globe, and it's still echoing. I mean, they're performing it on stage.
Yeah.
What was that like coming out? That must have meant recognition for you when Billy Elliot was done.
Yeah, absolutely. The strange thing was I kind of missed it because I was already working on Gangs of New York, which...
Hang on, name dropper.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, Martin Scorsese told me never name drop, but I forgot. And but that was supposed to be a 3-month shoot, and it went to seven months shoot.
Just looking at the sets, I could have told you there's no 3 months in that.
Yeah. 7 months in Rome. So Billy Elliot was premiering all over the world while I was in... Well, I was sitting having a pizza by the Trevi Fountain.
Were you out doing the promotion for Billy Elliot at least?
No, I couldn't because I was kind of locked into things. Yeah.
So that might have been sort of not a missed opportunity, but a missed chance for that exposure to be on the couch on the late night shows and around the world and doing all that stuff.
Yeah, I suppose so. But at least I was working on a good thing.
Let's move on to that good thing, Gangs of New York. You play sort of a nemesis, I would say, one of the catalysts in the story that's causing trouble in the among the gangs.
Yeah.
What was it like working first for Martin Scorsese? I mean, that must be mind-blowing just when you realize you're going to be working on a project with Scorsese. It must be a dream come true.
Yeah.
Or are you not a fan of his work? Maybe, you know, maybe you don't care about him.
No, huge fan
I'm from New York, so I have the connection there.
No. I was a huge fan of Martin Scorsese. And the whole process of getting cast... was kind of a strange. It was quite strung out. I met his casting director, Ellen Lewis, and in Glasgow, and she recorded some scenes. Excuse me. And then I would get these phone calls. I don't know how the hell they got my number. They would just say, "Marty really likes you. Marty really likes you." You know, and I'd be like doing things like hanging out the washing and stuff, and saying, "I'd say, well." Have I got the role? You know, what does this mean? You know, so I got kind of tired of it, you know, so I just kind of shelved it. And then I was asked to go and meet Martin Scorsese in Rome. And a very curious thing happened when I was studying for my final dissertation. I did a dissertation on the American labor movement and how it was different from the European labor movements. Like they didn't create a party of labor.
No.
Social Democratic Party in Germany or the Labour Party in the UK or something. So I went into a lot of detail about the early trade unions in the States. And when I was going, it was in Cinecittà in Rome, and people kept saying, "Oh, you're going to go and meet Marty." And I say, "Yeah, that's why I'm here." And then you'd be taken into another room and say, "Oh, you're going to meet Marty." I went, yep. And I said, "Jesus, it must be easier to meet the Pope. You know, this is really getting grindingly wearisome." And then eventually I go into the room and Martin Scorsese was so welcoming and down to earth. And lo and behold, you know, I asked a question about guns in these kind of fights. And he said, "You know, the way guns are portrayed in movies, you know, it's completely false. Like gunfights would go on for hours and hours because they didn't have endless supply of ammunition, you know, so it wasn't like bang, 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 bang." And I asked about, you know, talked about early strikes and where the bosses would employ armed gangs.
The scabs, yeah.
Yeah, to ask armed scabs, yeah, to break the strikes and shoot at the strikers. And he knew lots about this. So we ended up talking about early American labor history and gunfights. And I mean, wow. So I was actually interested in, like most people know, Martin Scorsese has an encyclopedic knowledge of cinema. But it was wonderful to know that he had such a deep knowledge of history as well. And we just sat there. Well, it's a Scottish expression called chewing the fat. We just sat there chewing the fat and... it was great, you know.
And obviously he found some comfort level with you.
Well, yeah. During the shoot, I was delighted to realize that he was very open to suggestions. He would actually consider anything which you presented him with. I mean, it had to be good. It had to be thought out, you know. I mean, I told him, like, because my character was a Catholic, but he had switched sides after the priest, the leader of the Dead Rabbits, had been killed. There's a scene where we are stoning, throwing fruit and stones at the poor Irish, starving Irish coming off the ships. And I said, I don't think I would be doing that, you know. I, as much as I'm a turncoat, I don't think I would stone my own people. And he said, what are you going to do? I said, you know, there's I've discovered this song in the, there was a book we got access to called The Rogue's Lexicon, which was New York street language. It was just fantastic. So I absorbed this stuff and threw a lot of the lines into the script. They're in the film. Stifle that rat bastard now. You know, I would just adapt these things from this book. And Martin Scorsese would allow you to do that. But he says, so what do you mean, you're going to sit and sing a song? I said, no, I'm going to play it in the harmonica. And he said, and where's McGloin going to get a harmonica in 1860 New York? And I hadn't gone that far with my thoughts. And he says, tell me tomorrow. So I phoned somebody, a friend in Glasgow, and asked for the whole history of harmonicas. And it was a German company, Hohner. And how could it have got to New York? How could McGloin have got access to a harmonica from a German sailor or something? And I justified the whole thing. And the next day he said, okay, get McGloin a harmonica, the oldest one we can find. And so that's in the scene. It's a small thing. I'm just sitting there playing this tune on a sack, but I'm not stoning my people, which was important for my character. It's just a small indication of how dynamic and thoughtful. I mean, I was incredulous at how much he would carry during the shooting of a scene. He would... There's a scene where Daniel Day-Lewis, Bill the Butcher, is walking towards Monk, Brendan Gleeson's character. And when Martin Scorsese is setting it up with Michael Bauhaus, the cinematographer, he's telling him when the speed changes in the camera, the positions, and then he's telling him when the music kicks in and when the music changes on the reverse shot and the different speed at this position. And I'm thinking, wow, he's carrying everything, every piece of sound and vision of this scene in his head right now, you know, as we're shooting it. He would change things depending on the light in Rome, you know, and it was quite something to work with him and to work with Daniel Day-Lewis.
I was going to ask about Daniel Day-Lewis, but now everyone can get a masterclass with Martin Scorsese online. I mean, it's phenomenal the way things are moving in this world.
Yeah.
Can I ask, this moment now that you've injected into the film, you know, that he's not going to throw the stones, he's going to play the song. How rewarding is it when you see that on screen, when, you know, when you go to see the film? Do you watch yourself? Have you seen it?
I've watched that film a few times,
Good for you. How rewarding is that when that scene comes up? How does that make you feel?
Yeah, well, initially the big reward was when he entered into dialogue about it and just entertained the idea. He accepted that you'd something to offer, because, I mean, a lot of the time, that's your role, you know, you want to offer more than is on the page, you know. Somebody told me, what was the phrase I heard last year? Beat the script. You got to beat the script or something like that. So, some of the things may be inappropriate, and the director sees things with a different eye from the actors, of course. You're calling from where you're calling from, but they're seeing the whole thing on the monitor, and they've got a different vision maybe. But if you can connect and engage with that and offer something more, well, that was the reward, when you listened and then he took it further and asked to justify it. But then you're absolutely right, when you see it, you go, wow, that's just a small thing. But, you know, there are lots of small details in that film which many people will never know the extent, the work that went into creating it. You know, there's a part of the, there's an early photograph of that area, the Five Points in New York, and it's just kids, you know, poor kids and men looking out of windows and standing in a little alley. And there's a sequence in the film where Scorsese recreates this instance. He recreates this photograph as part of a moving sequence. And if you don't know, you don't recognize it, but it's there. And it's like, I don't see it as pointless, because it's more than just an homage to a reference point, but he is acknowledging an actual photograph. Like, these people are long gone, but that's who was living in the Five Points.
It's their story.
It's their story.
And it's sort of an anchor point as well to be able to recreate that realistic moment. If you can weave enough of those and you know you're back in that place.
Yeah, it's a connection. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And it's, I just think that's a big deal, you know. It's a very small thing, but it's an anchor point which is real, you know.
I got so many different ways we can go here. I definitely want to ask a couple Daniel Day-Lewis questions, but it seems like you're very interested in the process. Will we ever see you writing or directing or creating your own work?
Wow, Jesus. I don't know. It's so, I mean, from what I've seen, it is so, so difficult to...
You don't have to do it alone.
To get a film made. Yeah, I've got stories and there are things, some small things I've written, but...
Doesn't have to be film, could be theater, TV.
I mean, well, maybe.
I just see that as a movement more and more that, you know, actors don't always just wait for work, they also create work this time. It's kind of an interesting phenomenon. I just wonder, the way you talk about the process with Scorsese, it feels like you're there.
Yeah, there are things I would like to do. I suppose maybe I just became a bit too busy, you know, and so I find it hard to focus on something when you're engaged in something else.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm not putting a requirement on you here. No, I just wanted to ask. Okay, back to Gangs of New York and Daniel Day-Lewis. Now, he's renowned as a retired actor, apparently?
Yeah, apparently
if we're supposed to believe. But he's renowned for his method and for staying in character, for being, you know, Abraham Lincoln for a month on the set of Lincoln. Was that the same experience in Gangs of New York?
Absolutely, yeah.
And what was that like for you as an actor? I mean, did you have to sort of meet him halfway in character while you're on the crafts line for food, or how does that work?
No, not halfway, all the way.
All the way, okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, okay, first off, I just think he's the best, you know. He's just...
Whatever he's doing is working for him.
Yeah, whatever he's doing. I mean, people would... I've seen crazy stuff written about him as if he's crazily eccentric, making shoes and stuff, you know. But I think what he does in his work... his life, you know, it's there. You can't, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. It's there on the screen. You're watching a truly great actor. And in answer to your question, he's Bill the Butcher all the time.
That must have been a little frightening.
Well, you said, I mean, once my kid, he was only five at the time, and I would not introduce him to Bill. You call him Bill, obviously, you don't call him Dan during the shoot, and I don't think that's a stupid thing, it's completely understandable, but there was such an aura of menace and violence that you wouldn't let your kids anywhere near this guy.
That's impressive, I would say. Yeah. I mean, I have complete respect for whatever it takes to get to that performance. I respect that, no question about it.
Yeah, me too.
And does that influence you at all in how you perform, how you approach things afterwards? Does it change anything about your approach as an actor to be exposed to that?
Well, for me, it was a lesson about focus and commitment. About really being prepared when you turn up for your work, being professional. I mean, he is super professional, and it's like he is incredibly generous. You know, if the camera is not on him, or if the camera was on a mountain on the back of his head, you know, like, it wouldn't matter where the camera was. He still gives 100%, and so that's a big lesson for an actor to see. You think he is one of the greats, and he's generous to a fault. He's totally focused, and he's just on the case all the time. So I'm very glad to have worked with him.
Yeah, it sounds like quite the experience. Sounds like someone you would want to at least get a chance to work with once.
Oh, yeah.
Congratulations, by the way. That's quite the film, really is.
I think it's a wonderful film.
Great job all around. not just yourself, but everybody.
Yeah, Jim Broadbent.
Really iconic.
Brendan Gleeson. So
we talked about Billy Elliot and Gangs of New York, two huge films. If you'd indulge me for a minute, you were in an Irvin Welsh penned film, Filth.
Filth,
and this is very Scottish to me. You're a proud son of Scotland. Irvin Welsh, also a proud son of Scotland, the author of Trainspotting and a couple of other things. That was with John Baer as the director.
John Baer.
Also has a Scorsese connection, right? He did the Vinyl for HBO. That was Scorsese and Mick Jagger were the producers on that.
I did not know that.
So just, maybe you led the way. Maybe you inspired him there. But what was the experience like on Filth? And was it something specifically Scottish about it or not for you as a performer?
Filth, well, specifically Scottish. Well, the main thing is it's Irvin Welsh.
Yeah.
Irvin Welsh is a great writer.
Yes.
There's stuff in Filth, the book and the film, which I just love. It's... I don't know where to start.
Yeah, I know. If you're not familiar with it, it's going to be hard to get your head around it. Go find the book or the film.
Yeah, I'd advise you to treat yourself to both, really. It's terrific that Welsh is such a great writer. He shows the the backstory for the cop is great. You know, what happened to him. You know that line in the film where the fellow cop says to him, he's talking about the corruption in the police. And the fellow cop says, so you wanted to get inside and change it? He says, no, I wanted to be a part of it.
Yes. And he's so beautifully venial. There's humor. I love that. It's just
yeah, but he's a disaster, you know. And it's not, oh, God. I love the writing and I love the film. And James McAvoy's portrayal is terrific. It's a really wonderful portrayal.
But as a Scotch actor, is it particularly, you know, fulfilling to get called to join in on that kind of a production? Do you feel the pride of, you know, a national pride?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great cast. I was also reunited with Jamie Bell. That was the first time I'd seen Jamie from Billy Elliot. We hadn't seen each other for 15 years or something. So with Jamie playing one of the cops, that was special as well. And a lot of really good Scottish actors in it. And Kate Dickie's in it. And yeah, I mean, she's phenomenal. And it's great writing, great film, great cast.
It's just phenomenal. I recommend it highly. I'm a big Irvin Welsh fan. Check it all out. If you've seen Trainspotting, maybe you have some idea of the kind of things that could happen, although it's very different, but very much worth watching. So we've talked about a few of your films, bigger, biggest, and smaller.
Yeah.
You've done also a bunch of TV. I would say that here in Scandinavia, people might recognize you from Outlander, where you did Colin McKenzie. That's quite the big hit here in Scandinavia.
I just realized that.
How did you, why? People are fine. You're doing the tour here. Gary's here today doing promotion for Rig 45. He's out talking to media all around. And so what, people are recognizing you for this?
Yeah, a couple of people told me they were big Outlander fans. And because Outlander initially was not broadcast in Scotland, which was kind of strange, obviously, ended up going out on Amazon Prime. But it kind of exploded all over the place, but it wasn't really big in Scotland. So I didn't know where it was popular, where it was being transmitted. So sometimes it's a surprise.
Interesting. Not knowing where your work is echoing. That's kind of weird. But that brings me to another question. I mean, the importance of the emergence of streaming services, that now Outlander has a life after the fact that people can find, you know, people can go find Gangs of New York or Filth today if they want to just dial it up. You're doing a production for Viaplay, which is a streaming service commissioning this Rig 45.
Yeah.
How does that echo with you as an actor? Does it mean anything, or is it the work is done, it doesn't matter?
No, I think, does it mean anything? Well,
sorry for the easy question.
that's a complex one. I mean, the work is out there. It's kind of strange that people can access stuff so readily. And, it's a hard one to get your head around.
I mean, that someone might find something you've done 20 years later.
Exactly. I mean, somebody recognized me from Brazil for a short film I'd done. years ago, you know, and I couldn't believe it. They were like, you were, and I mean, Jesus, apparently it was shown in the Brazilian public service channel endlessly, you know. So you never really know where people are coming from, how they know you or your work. Or
hopefully there's a residual check somewhere in the mail that says this, that it was playing all over the place.
No, don't get residuals for them. All these jobs you do for nothing, you know, all these short films are mostly free to help film students.
And you work with Scorsese for the experience.
No, that one was for Doe.
Good for you. Let's move on to Rig 45 while you're here. You're playing the lead, Douglas, or the co-lead, I would guess.
Oh, yeah, it's an ensemble piece.
Truly an ensemble piece, and a very interesting, like, cultural and international mix of performers.
I walked in, it was interesting going into the makeup room, and they had the cast up with the flags of where they were from. And it was quite something to see the Finnish, Norwegian, Danish, Swedish, Irish, Scottish. Did I miss anybody yet? I think that's the whole lot. What a cast. What an ensemble.
And for those of you who don't know, Rig 45 is a criminal drama set on an oil rig. A very interesting premise. And the rig is almost a character, filmed so lovingly by your director, all those exterior shots. But it's not straightforward. As I said, I've been lucky enough to see the first two episodes now here pre-launch, and I still don't know what's going to happen. But I'm very much leaning in, because every character that emerges brings another layer of drama to the story. And your character has multiple layers of drama.
I think you're absolutely right, and you put it very well.
Okay.
Every character brings multiple layers to it. So what's so good about this for me is that it's more than just something happened, then something else happened. Mm. The characters are very interesting. They don't just all have a story right there and right then. They have a backstory, and the elements of these backstories are playing out. There's so much. Like, you've seen the first two episodes, like me, and it gets deeper and darker. And
I like that it's not straightforward. Like, I have your character pegged as a bad guy, and then suddenly in episode two, he's taking action which actually seems from his heart to protect a coworker. So it's nice that it's not sort of black and white at all, you know? The fog is rolling in, there's shades of gray everywhere.
What you've picked up on is absolutely the case, you know? So you think you've got it pegged, but it's, people are presenting different things.
I'm waiting. I keep waiting to put my flag in what I think is going to happen. And again, every time it turns around, I'm like, ooh, pick the flag up. I don't know anything yet. Pick the flag up.
Yeah. It's intriguing. Like I say, they all carry stuff. Different agendas. They're up against, wow. I've said this a few times. I'm surprised nobody's ever thought of this before. It's a bit like Alien, you know, on an oil rig, nobody can hear you scream. It's a great idea. It's a great setting. And
I spoke to your co-star, Catherine Walker, and my comparison was The Shining. The idea that you're caught somewhere.
Very.
And now you have to, the people who are there have to solve this.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. There's locked in. That's the only way. So, I think it's a great premise, but it's more than just the setting. It's the characters and how each individual is playing this out. It's intriguing. It was intriguing for me reading it, because, what was so interesting was that you had a good foundation from which to explore a character. And in the course of the shoot, Per's a great director. You would get the chance to talk things through, work things out.
So will you be playing a harmonica?
No, and this one, I should have introduced that at some point, I need to get the guitar and juggling the plastic ducks in somewhere, show off all these skills. No, there was a space to bring ideas, and then there's just, like, once you're working with the other actors and getting direction from Per, and of course the other thing I have to mention, having seen a little during the filming of it and seen two episodes, is the cinematography is outstanding. Callie is Wow, just wow, a treasure, you know. He's such a skilled, wonderful guy. I don't think that must be one of the best.
I think you guys have quite the mix going on. You have quite the cast, yourself included. You have beautifully shot story,
yeah,
and you have this dense plot that really is a lot to work with as a viewer. There's a lot there for me, you know.
Oh, absolutely! It's
it's like no wasted space in the
nothing.
Story.
No. I mean, from episode one, there's some questions posed. You're intrigued. You're wondering what's then it shifts a gear in episode two. Then it's just going to get better and better.
I imagine once now you're all trapped, I would think that they're going to turn it up a notch in terms of the drama and the adrenaline.
Yeah. It is in every sense of the word thrilling. And I couldn't second guess it. I didn't know what the hell was going on.
Nice. That must be a surprise. I would guess that more often when you get scripts, like the beats feel familiar all the way through.
Yeah, no, this is original. But it's more than just clever. You know what I mean, Brian? Sometimes you read stuff and it's very clever. But you're thinking, something's not registering here.
Clever for the sake of cleverness.
Yeah, I know what
you mean. Yeah.
And it's, you kind of walk away thinking, yeah, that was really smart, but what the hell was in it, you know? What was the stuff? What was the substance, you know? What was the... But this is different.
I have to say, you're quite the actor, because the man I see here is not Douglas at all, so I'm quite...
Oh, hell, he's a hell of a guy.
No, but often, you know, you see actors, even great actors, and it's, okay, that's them. And other times there are actors where you'll be 15 minutes into the film and you go, oh, that's them, because they're so hidden in their characters. And that's kind of the vibe I get from you, which is my compliment to you.
Oh, thanks very much, Brian.
In case you didn't understand, that's where I was going. So Rig 45 is up and running. You guys have finished the whole series. Working on anything else?
Not for sure. That's always a difficult one because of the precariousness of filmmaking. There is a project which I'd rather not say because it may sink.
Macbeth.
And it's so difficult for anybody to get a film made. You wonder sometimes the finance just collapses and that doesn't happen. But yeah, hopefully not. But okay. I just kind of like to keep the campfire small until it's actually 6 in the morning and you're standing there.
Well, I can't imagine you're going to disappear, so we'll keep our eyes open for what comes next. If it was your choice, what would you like to do? What's the dream role? What's the dream project?
Well, man, that's a big one. There are some plays I would definitely love to do. There are some directors I would definitely love to work with and some actors to work alongside, but maybe I should plant a few wishing trees, but I'm quite happy.
Listen to this podcast, I'm sure.
I'm a big fan of Roy Anderson. I watched his work and I was just incredulous, you know, just incredible filmmaking.
Human touch around that stuff. I can see why you'd like that. If you like the Ken Loach stuff, there's something going on somewhere.
Yeah, really, really wonderful. But so much. I mean, there are so many great writers and directors, and see what happens.
I'll let you go on one more question, and a little not so big, but hopefully interesting answer. You know, you're in this Rig 45, which is a Scandi noir drama, mm-hmm. and you know, the Scandis have really made a mark sort of in this area. Can we expect something to emerge from Scotland that sort of with a Scottish imprint of sort of a genre that you take over, and maybe based on the tradition of Welsh? I don't know. Is there anything emerging? What's the scene there?
You see, that's a really good question, because it kind of looks like we're hanging on your coattails right now. You know, the Shetland, which Joey Johansson, the Icelandic actor who's in Rig 45, Joey worked on Shetland. And it's good, it's very good, but it's maybe closer to Scandinavian Nordic noir than something truly original. But that's a great idea. I mean, I'm going to take that question back and pose it to a few people.
Daniel Blake, is that Scottish in your mind?
No, that was filmed in Newcastle.
UK, yeah, okay.
Aye. Ken Loach is working on another one right now in Newcastle as well, I think. But no, that's a very good question. You've actually got me thinking here, something which Scotland could make its mark on. And yeah, I mean, you guys have really, you lifted things, you know, you set the bar. You made some of the homegrown, like crime dramas in Scotland, look terribly staid, old-fashioned.
But these things go in cycles. I mean, we'll move on to something else here in Scandinavia, and there'll be a room for that for someone else to pick up. But I would imagine, though, again, that since there are so many more places to go with content, it's not just, you know, I don't know, 25 years ago in Europe, it was your public broadcasters, and then some commercial channels emerged, and now we have all these streaming services. Yeah. So there has to be room for sort of these clusters of production to emerge, in my mind.
Yeah, I would hope so. But I would also hope, in connection with your question, that it would be something original, you know, that it would be exploratory. And
or something that comes from the traditional Scottish heart.
Yeah, yeah, that's really what it should be, rather than hanging on the coattails of what others are doing.
Well, then I'll be commissioning you to dust off the work you've done in history around the labor movement, because I think it's pretty much high time to remind people, especially in my country, about the importance of that.
Brian,
that might be your niche.
You've got me thinking. You really have got me thinking.
Well, I won't keep you anymore, Gary. You've been doing the work all day. I'm looking forward to see how Rig 45 unfolds. I would recommend anyone listening to check it out on Viaplay starting in June. The great Gary Lewis. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Pleasure, man. Thanks.
Wow, that was fun. What an interesting guy. I mean, beyond the acting, his interest in history, his interest in the workers' movement, and how sort of that background helped him click with Martin Scorsese and eventually land that role in Gangs in New York. Really interesting, well-rounded guy. Pleasure to meet him. Gary Lewis. Once again, thanks, Gary, for taking the time. And thank you for taking the time to find us and listen in. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Once again, I'm Brian Laffin, and this has been an episode of Stream Close-Up. If you like what you're hearing, tell a friend to tell a friend to tell a friend. You know how that works. We'll be back very soon. We've got Gary's Rig 45 co-star Catherine Walker scheduled, so keep your eyes out for that and check out Rig 45, premiering right now on Viaplay. As always, we'd like to thank the good people at I Like Radio for giving us a home. You can find a bunch of great podcasts and radio there, so check them out at ilikeradio.se. And of course, we would not sound so good without the help of our producer and musical director, Jose Fernandez Alameda. Take us out, Jose.